And it's, I think one of the problems is people want things to be perfect, especially with like starting a business. They're like, with working out, it's always like, oh, I'm going to start on Monday. And then if I miss Monday, next Monday, or like the routine is off, some nonsense. And they do the same businesses where they're like, I have to have enough money saved in the bank to like quit my job to do my thing. And it's like, life is just not perfect. It just can't be. So like, you have to accept the imperfection and just take action toward whatever the thing is that you want to do.
All right, we're recording, Jimmy. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Zoltan.
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking about before this, how it's so crazy that, you know, how small the LinkedIn world is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, it's wild.
Yeah.
Very, very small world.
I know.
Most of my friends in like the on.
That's so awesome. Now, all right. So you're the owner of No Bake Cookie Dough, which is pretty awesome. I work for Dirty Dough right now. We're a franchise. So we're both in like the cookie space. So I feel like we'll have a pretty fun conversation. But there was something interesting that you brought up before we met that I kind of wanted to dive into. And yes, that's changing strategies, or not being afraid to change your business strategy, even when you know it's going to temporarily or for however long crater like your revenue or your opportunities. So tell me a little bit about how you like, well, you know, what made you want to do that, and like how you, I guess, got the risk tolerance to even take that leap.
Yeah. So, I'll kind of back up a little bit and give you like the short or the long story, like a little shorter. So when we founded No Baked in 2017, the original idea was to open scoop shops. So at the time, there weren't a bunch of scoop shops where people were scooping edible cookie dough. This is March of 2017. Mm-hmm. I think there were only like three in the whole country, maybe two. And we got our first scoop shop open in October. And we like really doubled down on that strategy. We paid for franchising documents to be made. That next summer, we sold our first three franchises. And then we proceeded to open up five more stores ourselves. So by October of 2019, we were at our 8 stores. We had 3 more that were going to open in the next 6 months. It just didn't feel right. And we were really hesitant to pivot. We knew that, hey, we relaunched the online store. That's doing really well. Maybe that's the channel that we should be in. We shouldn't necessarily be in scoop shops, or we shouldn't be in franchising. And by that point, we had shut franchising down. So we weren't trying to sell any more franchises, because we sold the first three, and then we didn't really anticipate how hard it would be to replicate success that you had had, like, you know, in Nashville, Louisville, and some of the other places we were at. We had had like huge grand openings and tons of success, and the stores were making lots of money. And so replicating that in other markets was hard, and we didn't really know why. And to be honest, we were really young. So that was kind of our first pivot. We were really, really hesitant to do it. And the only thing that kicked us into high gear to pivot away from that model was COVID.
Yeah. So
we drug our feet for like 9 months. Should we switch to D2C? Like, should we start doing packaged goods? Like, maybe we need to raise money. And then COVID just forced us to shut our stores down.
Dude, really, that's wild.
Basically pushed off the cliff that we needed to go off of, right?
Yeah.
Fast forward 2 more years, or about a year and a half, and you're in the end of 2021. And a lot of people know this if they're like in D2C at all, but at the beginning of 2021, there was the iOS update. The whole thing where Facebook ads stopped being as efficient at the purchase point. So like the CPMs and a lot of the other metrics that you get with like a Facebook ad were still really good, and they were actually really affordable. People just weren't buying because it wasn't targeting customers as well as it had before. What that caused for a lot of brands, and especially for ours, if you have a low or average order value, so if your average order value is below $100, as just like a random metric you could throw out, you're probably not going to ever make money in D2C. Just not going to, you're going to lose money forever. I don't care what your lifetime value is. You'd have to have a giant bag of cash. We're talking like 8 figures.
Yeah.
Just spend on ads and burn. And just light it on fire to even find out if the LTV thing was going to work. So most brands don't have that kind of cash in reserve, and most people aren't willing to take that kind of crazy risk. So, which a lot of people lean into their current strategy, though.
Yeah.
And we really needed to pivot as a brand. So we had built sales up to about $250,000 a month online.
Oh, wow.
The scoop shops were all back open, the ones that were performing well. So the brand was doing really well. And then at the end of 2021, we were like, we're doing really well revenue wise. We're lighting like $40,000 a month on fire. Like, and we can't sustain that. We're a bootstrapped company. We had only done one small funding round, which is a crowdfunding round. So we get to the end of 2021, like September, October, and Megan looks at me and she's like, we should shut off ads. All ads. No more ads at
all.
And we both kind of knew what happened. A lot of people, see, this is what everybody claims, is one day I'll be profitable. I can shut my ads off. Because I found out what happened. People just stop caring. Because we live in a world that's so busy with so many brands and so many emerging brands, so many legacy brands, so many people online pummeling you with ads, pummeling you with information. You get hit with content from TikTok, content from Instagram, organic, paid. People are like actually absorbing more information today than they ever have before. And we all know that. So it's not just in the physical world, but it's in the digital world.
Right.
So if you turn off ads, what happens is there's someone else that takes place. No matter how good your product is, no matter how awesome it is, like we did retain some customers, but our revenue cratered. It cratered to the point where, like, today, yeah, it's still completely organic, but like we're selling like $10,000-$15,000 a month, you know, online.
Yeah.
Strategy we had to let die because it's a losing strategy.
You talking about you saying like perpetual paid ads?
Yeah. Perpetual paid ads, which is what every D2C brand is in, and they always will be. Yeah. There is no way out of that model. Not currently. There are some brands that have made their way out of it. You could point at Athletic Greens. You could point at Lululemon's D2C sales are up actually year over year. They're doing really well, but they're Lululemon.
They're brick and mortar. They're more of a brick and mortar, I would say, than D2C. Right?
But their D2C sales are up. But
yeah, that goes to show that,
like, if you build a legacy brand or you build this like enormous like platform, yeah, you too could do this. But Lululemon started back in like the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So like for someone who's
compare
themselves to that is insane.
Right. So that Lululemon and Athletic Greens did something really interesting. Like Lululemon really doubled down on their influencers and ambassadors, and Athletic Greens, I feel like from my perspective in just a little bit that I saw about them, they doubled down on podcasting. So like really like that. So it's kind of funny how we went full circle, right? Like social media was supposed to be this thing that brought communities together all around the world. Yeah. And like we left guerrilla marketing, kind of like that, you know, door to door was like all, you know, they're like, who would ever do that? Or like podcasting or some of this like guerrilla stuff. But now we've kind of come full circle where those brands who've gone back to like their roots essentially are like doing quite well with podcasting and ambassadors and community. And it's a really interesting kind of turn in the e-com space.
It really is. And it just goes to show that like you have to be a little bit more organic. You have to be really patient. It can work, and it can work at scale maybe, but it doesn't work with high customer acquisition costs. And we just live in a more competitive world than we did 10 years ago, even 4 years ago.
Right.
So that was the real pivot that we made without fear. And the first time that we were like, screw it, like we'll create a revenue. Like, doesn't matter. Because revenue is a vanity metric. Of course, our company is valued off of revenue. Everyone else in our space is valued off of revenue. So it craters your valuation. It craters the way that people look at you. But at the end of the day, if you're a real operator and like you're in this for the long haul, you want to build a business that's going to be here for a while, then you don't like raise money, turn and burn, you have to do things that are scary. They aren't like for vanity, because growing revenue is really for vanity if you're not doing it in a profitable way. It's either to get a higher valuation so you could raise more money, or it's to basically like say, hey, we're like going to the moon with some, there is some end game in mind typically with like an exit. You're not actually looking to ever make money. And that's right. Fine. Fire has to see, I guess, the value in like the customer base you've built. But in my mind, a brand is really only truly valuable if it can figure out how to make money and sell its product for a profit. So for us, what we realized after that pivot and since then is that being an omni-channel brand, similar to Lulu or similar to, you know, Van Leeuwen is another really good example.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bottle coffee. Like people that like, I have a coffee shop and then I have these bottles of coffee in the store and like eventually they got acquired by Nestle, but it was like an omni-channel brand. And same thing with Van Leeuwen, like very omni-channel, very similar to us. I have scoop shops where I sell my ice cream. I can sell it online. I sell it in the grocery store. You can sell it on GoPuff. And people can kind of interact with the brand in different ways and different channels. Those are really all my customer at the end of the day. And I don't want to lean into one channel too hard to where we get in the situation again where it's like, oh, we're relying on paid ads from Facebook. And if paid ads from Facebook stop working, our entire business is going to crumble.
Like, yeah, isn't that, that's wild, dude. And that's kind of why I have, and we talked a little bit about this too, but like I've kind of doubled down on podcasting. Like I, you know, whenever I talk to brands or whatever about, you know, marketing, and it doesn't happen very often, like I'm a sales guy by trade. So, but it's interesting because like my podcast has kind of taken over for like, I don't really do paid ads for much of my stuff. Number one, because like, I don't have the money to spend on it to make it make sense. Like you were talking about earlier, Jimmy. And the other thing is like, you have to like, to create a legacy brand like that, you've really got to focus on community. Like Lululemon is a cult.
Yeah, it is. It is it's a quarter of a century old.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's old. Yeah. You're right. You're right. But they built that.
You could also look at Nike. I'm like wearing it. Nike didn't get built over, like people are just too impatient days. Nike was built over the course of like almost half a century.
Right, and it didn't become
Nike until you're talking about like the 90s. It's a company that's like the ideation for it happened in the 60s.
Yeah. So,
like a longer time. What people are giving themselves.
I like that you mentioned that. Why do you think so many people are impatient when it comes to e-commerce and DTC specifically?
Because of social media.
Yeah.
I mean, we both like live in it and I live in it. Yeah. Bad. So it's like, if you're on LinkedIn or you're trying to be like an influencer, like I do, because I think it brings community. Right. And I love people on there. And I love the idea that like, if I get connected enough or enough people follow me, then maybe people will be exposed to our brand. And that's good for the brand and it's good for the future of the business. But like the toxic like underbelly to that is like, I'll go on there and I inevitably will end up comparing myself to all these other entrepreneurs who are at different stages of life, different stages of life, different ages, different whatever. And it's like, I try to avoid thinking about the fact that like, hey, whoever it is just exited for $90 million. Why am I for $90 million? Like,
right.
Shit. Or like the Forbes 30 to 30 thing is like another thing that I find to be, I'm really honored that they were like, you're on the list, but another one of those things where like, okay, it's like everyone's going to go out and flex on it. And then if you get that thing, you're suddenly like not
less or whatever. Yeah. Whatever.
And like that stuff creeps into people's minds. It's been creeping into my mind for 6 years.
Yeah.
I've been impatient the entire time until very recently. Where it's like, when I was 23 and we started, I was a lunatic for being like, we're going to the moon. But I guess that's kind of part of the mindset you have to have as an entrepreneur. But then the more you expose yourself to other people on social that are like, honestly, fake flexing, like they don't actually have money. They're only, you know what the funniest thing is? Whenever you go out with like a funding round or like you're going to go raise money, which is something we're doing right now, and you get introduced to certain people who are private investors, there's always someone who's like, yeah, this guy's a billionaire. And you know, there's only like 2,000 billionaires on Earth. So like the idea that, and like, we don't know how many are liquid. Like you have
$1 billion.
And it's like, I find it funny how often people throw around these ridiculous terms like, oh, he's a billionaire. Like they're killing it. Like whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, are they? And like that expectation that we're constantly thinking these people are like more successful than they are. And then you feel like you should be in a place where you're not. And that's bad. And then you start making bad decisions to try to go faster, which I don't want to do. That would be like me saying, like, we need to raise money, spend money on ads, like YOLO it into like more grocery stores, like not support the product, see if we can just get sales up and then exit this thing and let it crash and burn. Like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's a lot of entrepreneurs' mindset is like, I want to start this, piece it together good enough and then sell it, and we don't care what happens after that. It's kind of crazy. And you know what's even crazier is you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people compare themselves without knowing the full story. I think that's a big conversation about why, you know, I think that's the main point, or at least should be the main point, of why we're having all these social media conversations. I don't think anything should be banned, but I certainly think that there should be age limits, right? But like, because it's this idea that like, if you don't have that mature mindset, or at least are able to get there quickly of like, hey, look, this is like all crazy. Like, I shouldn't be comparing myself to this guy. Cause I do that with my podcast. Like, I'll look at people like, not even Joe Rogan, cause that's clearly like, yeah, I'll never like, or whatever. Right. Like, he clearly had something going for him, but like, even some people who I'm on the same level with, who I feel like I'm on the same level with, I'll be like, dude, what's going on? Like, what am I doing wrong or anything like that? And it's like, oh, you forgot that like he was a club owner and would literally had invited really famous people to his clubs for 15 years. And so he has connections. And so that's why the first episode was with Gary Vee or whatever, like, cause he knew him personally. And it's like, oh, well, yeah. I mean, like, if I knew Gary Vee personally too, I'm sure he would have come on my podcast, but like, how can you sit there and keep running down this rabbit hole? Like, just do what you got to do and like make something people want to listen to or like partake in or whatever. Right.
Yeah. And when you fall down the comparison trap, you inevitably lock yourself off from things like being able to like pivot your business or like quit your job.
Right.
Or like what you need to do to get there. So like, you know, and my friends who know me personally, like my best friends have watched me struggle for 6 years on the ups and downs.
Yeah.
And they know that like, it's not pretty. Like, you know, I'll go and hang out with my friends who have like 9-to-5 jobs. And there'll be times where I'm like, yo, like me and Megan, at certain points, we made tons of money from No Baked. Whereas like, yeah, like we would go and like pay for everybody's drinks at a bar, or like we go on a trip and like get the house and like everyone's like having fun. And then there's other times where like, I'm so broke, I can't like pay for my apartment. And like my friends are like buying me lunch and stuff because they feel bad. But they've like that like it's not a straight line. And it's also not something that you could ever compare to someone else, because it's like your business is so specific, what you're doing is so specific, and the minute you start getting into comparison, you start like just shutting yourself off from being able to make like scary decisions. Like, would you want to come with my life and like grind away, not get paid?
Like,
it's not going to look good, or your family might judge you. But like, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you should be like, hey, I don't care what anyone else thinks. Like, I just want to do this thing that I love. Same with your podcast. It's like,
don't
care if who's listening. It's like, eventually I hope people find value from it. And you're probably doing it for a specific reason. Like, maybe you just like talking to people and it's like your thing. But whenever people are successful, that's the mindset they're taking.
Right. And I've learned so many things about hanging out with more wealthy people. Like, one thing that I learned that was a kind of a surprise, and I don't know why, but hanging out with wealthy people, like, they're really nice. they're actually pretty nice, and they're actually willing to help you. And that's why you get the whole like give thing. But then the other thing that I've learned is like, they all started with this thing of like, if, you know, I know that it's cool to go to like a trade, like a speech event or whatever, and hear that entrepreneur who said, I have to help a billion people or whatever. But I know most of them were just like, dude, I wanted to do this for myself. Like, I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. And if no one bought it or listened or partook in or whatever, like, I just had to do it. And like, that is actually more common in my experience than the, I got to help a billion people, so I did, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, no, you're completely right. And there's this misnomer that like everybody starts with the big idea, the big thing, when really most entrepreneurs, like even in our case, like No Baked is started by Megan, like not me. And the reason it was started by Megan and not is she made the product for herself. So she was already making this cookie dough. She thought, I should share this with other people. I think I can sell this. I think people will see value in it. Kind of solve the problem for myself and we'll see where it goes. Yeah. And then like, when I hopped in like a month into it or whatever, I was like, oh, we can take this thing here and like what it could be. But like the initial ideation is not necessarily coming from a place of like, let's go make millions of dollars or billions of dollars or whatever. It's coming from a place of, I want to solve this little problem. Yeah. And similarly, I spoke recently with this other founder in healthcare. There's a lot of them here in Nashville, big healthcare town. And like, he runs a supplement business that he started back in 2013. It's kind of like anti-aging stuff. They're a really cool like company called Elysium Health, and their ideation moment wasn't like, let's go like end aging or let's go like make millions of dollars. It was literally like they read this white paper, they thought it was really cool. Like, I don't think anyone else is going to do this. I think I should quit my job, and then like quit his job because he was just so interested in it. And it had nothing to do with money. He was like, for the first like year and a half, we were just like, we're not really sure what we're doing, but like, we're really into this. And I think more entrepreneurs should do that. And he had told me, so when he started that company, he was living in Palo Alto. And he was like, if you go to Silicon Valley, anywhere around the Bay Area, you'll go to coffee shops. There's all these people sitting around trying to come up with ideas for businesses. That is a terrible thing to do. He was like, we saw it all the time on like the investor side where it's like, you guys come at, you're like, Instagram's popular. Like maybe we could do like Instagram for dogs or like something nonsense where it's like, you guys are just like, you're reaching. Yeah. You're not looking to like be inspired or have like a serendipitous moment. And that might sound frustrating for some people who are like, I want to just quit my job and do something. But like, you should wait for something that you like. I don't know for people, but it's like, you should find the thing that you love and you should lean into that.
I think people get into a lot of trouble in life in general, whether it's coming up with a business idea or in sports or like writing or whatever. I think people get into a lot of trouble when they start to force things. And that's what those meetings you're talking about are. They're just like, we're trying to force something that is not there. And it's just like sports, right? Like my favorite analogy for this is golfing, because it's very easy to see when someone who's golfing is forcing it. Like it's pretty easy to tell. Like if you're a basketball player, you can tell if you know what I mean? But anybody can go onto the golf course and be like, that guy's trying too hard. He should probably relax.
Really quick when it's like they're forcing it and they keep messing up.
Messing
up over again and they just keep
and they're like, they're like, why is this happening? Or why is this happening? He's like, dude, you got to like take a step back. I think one of the term, I can't remember where it's from. It's an old Eastern like religion saying that's like wu wei, which is like effortless action. Like basically like it's not forcing, you're not forcing anything. You're like going with the flow. And the way they describe it is like a river. And I really like that analogy because like a river is powerful and strong, but it doesn't like force anything. It takes its time. It goes with where it needs to go. You know what I mean? And then they end up very powerful. Right. It's just like, that's kind of how it is. You know, that's why we have all of our good ideas in the shower, dude. Water is powerful. Anyway, that's a side one.
That's a good point. I'm all about that. And thinking about, I don't know. I had another friend that like the river analogies are great. Cause he recently told me, he was like, if life is a river, he's like, you either like sit back, relax and like float along with everything. Or you can like try to fight the current. Or you could like hop in a boat and like go down the river. I like the boat thing. Like you could still like do actions, but you should do them in a way that like goes with where your life is, with the flow.
The flow of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is hard. It is hard, but it's actually a lot easier. It's only hard, in my opinion, because people are so scared of the unknown. Like we grew up in this entrepreneurial world of like smart goals and you know, big, hairy, audacious goals. And if I'm not hitting a goal, like something's wrong. And I really don't believe that. Like I hate smart goals. I think smart goals are the way to not do anything. Like, in my opinion, I don't know.
mental masturbation for a lot of people.
Yeah, goals,
and then like I think about achieving the goal, and then like I read the self-help book, and then I read the business book, and then I don't do anything. And it changes anything about your life. Like whenever I'm reading like a book, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna like read this thing, and then like if it's a book that's like nonfiction, in some form or fashion, I'm gonna apply it to my life somehow. Like I would never also like listen to a podcast and be like, oh, that was a cool idea, and then just like move on. Just listen to the podcast, don't take the time, but like there is one one of the things that like helped me like get into like health, which is totally unrelated, or like working out, was listening to Peter Attia on like Joe Rogan or like somewhere say like if you're in the top 2% of like VO2 max on like as far as like humans, like your chances of dying are like 7 times less.
Yeah.
Like all cause mortality. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I'm going to start running. And it's like, that's how my brain works though. I'm like, I hear something that sounds like a good thing. And then I'm like, oh, how could I get there? And I just like do it. Or just do some form of action. And it's, I think one of the problems is people want things to be perfect, especially with like starting a business. They're like, with working out, it's always like, oh, I'm going to start on Monday. And then if I miss Monday, next Monday. Or like the routine is off, some nonsense. Yeah. And they do the same businesses where they're like, I have to have enough money saved in the bank to like quit my job to do my thing. And it's like, life is just not perfect. It can't be. So like you have to accept the imperfection and just take action toward whatever the thing is that you want to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and just to go back to that, people just, I heard Mike Posner say once, and it came from a quote, but his story was really cool when he put that quote into action. When he went to do like this silent retreat or whatever, and he gets to the cabin and he realizes that like in a few minutes of just being silent and being at the cabin, that he starts making up things to do. And so the quote is, and so he realizes the truth of this quote, that is, how many things do we like make up or whatever just because we can't sit with ourselves alone in a room?
Mm.
You know what I mean? And people just aren't okay with like, like it's fun to write about on LinkedIn or to read about that entrepreneurship has highs and lows. But it's not fun to, most people are like, but it's actually not fun to be in the highs and lows. Like, you're going to do a lot as an entrepreneur, and sometimes you're not going to get those growths right away. Like sometimes you're playing the long game. Sometimes, you know, you're doing things as a loss leader, like that you just know. That you just know aren't going to go anywhere for 2 or 3 years, but you have to do it.
Yeah. And it's really frustrating to do. And like, and then you have to feel like, oh, I don't have the money to do it. And it's like, well, then you got to figure out how to like create money. And it's like, well, I give you an example, like this is super relevant. So like we brought production of our cookie dough back in house from a co-man, and in between like having our production facility completely ready and like switching from the co-man, I'm like, we're just going to scoop all of the jars in our scoop shop. And our employees were like, are you completely insane? And I was like, I am.
You're like, of course.
But like there's a method to the insanity, and the method is that like every single time we scoop a jar of cookie dough here, and someone was already being paid to be in the scoop shop to sit and tend the shop and do whatever it is they're doing, that's a free jar. Like there's no labor attached to that jar. I mean, you could have accountants argue with me on this, but this is the facts of it, is that the person was going to be here making $15 an hour regardless.
Yeah.
Like if they make some jars while they're here, then I sell those jars to, I don't know, KE, P10, like other distributors, or I sell them to a grocery store down the street. Those jars had no labor attached to them. So now the margin on that jar is like 70%.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, it's the difference between.
By like just being creative, and like people don't do that. You could do that if you're a solopreneur. You could be like, I'm just going to work. Or like, I don't want to, I want to outsource like my email marketing, but like, what if you did it yourself? Because you're broke. Like you have no budget. when people are broke, or I mean, not when people are broke, when people are not broke, but they're like, I don't have enough resources to do this thing. You can create the resources by just realigning where you're spending your time.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of people think about, like, everyone will always get at me. They're like, why are you out there making cookie dough, Jimmy? And I'm like, well, this week I want to make payroll. Like, I don't. Sometimes it's easier than like going and borrowing money to just be like, well, where could we fit ourselves into the business this week where we could add some value, where we could have some impact, because I'm not doing it right now.
And that's why I freaking hate the term passive income. It's such a anytime. So every once in a while I get people who ask me to be on the podcast, and if their tagline has any form of passive income in it, it's an automatic no for me. Cause I'm like, you're selling people a lie. Yeah. Like, that's what I like, dude, because this, right? Like, I'm sure it would be nice if you had like somebody who would do this and you could sit on a beach in Aruba drinking Mai Tais and not have to worry about your cookie shop. But the reality is if you want to make this shit work, you gotta have some skin in the game. Yeah. You know what I mean?
You and I've seen that firsthand. It's why franchising was so hard. Like,
yeah, franchising's hard.
We're like, this is a rental house. It's like, it's not a rental house.
Right. Oh my gosh, dude. I'm in franchising right now, and that's tough. Because it's this idea that they were sold by Robert Kiyosaki that you don't have to do anything and money floats into your bank account, and it's bullshit.
It is bullshit in the sense that, like, even so, like, if that was true, I will if that was true.
Yeah.
Wealthy people wouldn't have family offices.
Right.
They would be like, oh, I have all this money. I guess I don't have to do anything now.
Right.
We hire multiple people and pay them literally millions of dollars in payroll to manage their money. With it. And it's like that complicated to have. So if you build a business, that too takes management. Or if like you have rental properties, I'm sorry, man. But like,
dude, rental properties are hard to manage.
Yeah, I have a friend that does that for a living, and he calls it his business because he's working all the freaking time. And there'd be some people that are like, oh, well, he's doing it wrong. And I'm like, no, he's not. And he has a lot of it's like he owns like multiple apartment buildings. So each building has its own management team. He has to manage them. Like literally the buck stops with you. So it's like, even if you have people in place to do the little things, there's still, it always happens at our scoop shops with like restaurants in general, where it's like, oh, we're out of this item, and like no one knows where to get it or knows what to do. And eventually the question goes up the chain and makes its way to Megan or me.
Yeah.
And like when it makes its way to Megan or me, like, of course we're working. So it's like, I can't say that there's such a thing as passive.
Well, and why would you want that to be passive? Like, we have some people who, you know, I had a conversation the other day with someone, and I was like, they're like, so-and-so is not profitable. And I was like, the last time so-and-so was in that building was 7 months ago. How could you expect in any reality that would be profitable?
Yeah.
Like no one's going to care about your business as much as you. You should do it. And I think the term passive income just opens the door for all this gaslighting and like this MLM stuff of like, oh, you didn't work hard enough. No, dude, it's shitty. You tried to tell somebody that they didn't have to do anything and that they would make as much money. And it was not true. Like that idea is just.
It is a lot of gaslighting. You're like, you got the guru who's like, guys, like all you got to do is buy 12 houses, refi them, and suddenly money will appear.
Or gosh.
Oh, like I just acquire businesses for a living. And like that, this is the one that gets me. I get really upset with this. The people are like, I buy boring businesses and they cash. And I'm like, I'm just going to go ahead and say that unless there's a really good management team and unless there's a guy doing sales, that's bullshit.
Like, absolutely.
A person driving sales into a business. And the biggest reason small businesses fail, like the people that are like, but go buy a laundromat. Dude, my dad had a laundromat when I was a kid. And it was a pain in his ass. And
it
then
is a pain in the ass.
They decided to open 5 more laundromats. And when they did this, they proceeded to not have enough sales to cover their bills. or their debt. Because that's the number one problem with scaling a small business, is that people don't realize you have to scale sales. Like, and you scale them hard. Like, people underestimate how difficult it is to get someone to buy something. So all of the gurus out there that are like, it's easy. It's like, no, it's not. You sell someone something, anything, pick the item. It's like, if you've gotten someone to buy anything, that's really impressive. And if you are telling people all they have to do is worry about like getting debt to go buy a thing, they're not thinking about how do I sell stuff to create actual value and to actually succeed. Because the only way you're actually going to succeed by selling something.
And
the operation can be trash. That's the other like hidden secret that people don't realize. Like, the operation of your business, garbage. Everything can be shit. The marketing can be but as long as you're selling, literally no one cares. Like, because you're making money and you can fix all of the problems.
Well, sales does fix a lot of issues. Yes.
Yeah. It will create a lot of issues too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, 100%.
The marketing people will be like, oh, no, what do we do? The clients will be like, we can't pay for this. But at the end of the day, all of those are solvable problems by just like making strategic decisions. When sales, on the other hand, sales is not solvable if you have no sales.
The only way, and to kind of bring this conversation full circle, like when you're struggling with sales, dude, you need like boots on the ground. You need old school, like, and this is also like, I've been in sales for over a decade, right? And so it makes sense that I can have an opinion on what I'm about to say. And that is, every time I hear somebody say cold calling's dead or door to door is dead or cold emailing's dead, I'm like, just stop. Because if you don't have any sales and you're not cold calling, like if I was maybe an investor, right? If I was an investor and I invested in a business and then they said that one day, I don't have any sales, and I go, okay, well, are you making cold calls or you going door to door? I read somewhere on LinkedIn, that's a waste of time. Okay, well, now I'm pissed, because not only do you not have sales, but you're not even acting like you're trying to get sales.
That's a big pet peeve of mine and Megan. For instance, there's like little stores around Nashville every week. I text the managers. I say, hey, you guys need any cookie dough? I'll drive around to their stores and visit them. I will put the cookie dough in the refrigerator. We have branded refrigerators in some of those stores. I move 20 to 30 cases of cookie dough a month at each of those stores. It is. So like, for reference, like Toll House moves like a case and a half per Kroger, like per Kroger location there. Like we are murdering it because we're actually selling.
Because you got to like get out there and do it. Yeah.
Other friends who sells coffee, and he's like B2B sales. Like that's where he like cut his teeth. He cold calls. He cold calls hotels and he gets them to buy his coffee. And it's like, dude, why? He's not sitting on his ass. He's not sitting there saying, will this happen? Like,
well, I know.
Or like, we had moments where we needed to like create cash because we're like, shit, we don't have any money. We need to make this payment in like a week. Yeah. I cannot tell you how many times it's like, oh, wait, like, let's call up our biggest account, which like this year was like DoorDash, for instance. And we're like, let's pitch them an idea. Hey, we'll do a seasonal flavor for you once a month. Can we ship 3 cases of it to all of your stores in the next week?
Yeah.
And they're like, sure. Well, you just made a ton of money. Like that created like literally tens of thousands of dollars in like an instant. And then you were like, all it took was just selling, or like go check in on the stores that you're selling in. In CPG, go check in on the grocery stores. If you don't see it on the shelf, call the person responsible for putting it on the shelf. Simply selling. Like, marketing is but you have to sell.
Well, yeah, just staying top of mind. Like, that's the other thing, is like when I used to like teach people sales, and like I tried to go down that like sales coach path, and like I spent maybe like 2 weeks there and like realized that was like the worst place to be, because it's just kind of like what you said. And I've been doing this podcast long enough with amazing entrepreneurs that like, selling is not that fucking hard. Just give a shit about your company and other people. Like, dude, that's not an annoying phone call. Like, oh, I didn't see my cookie dough on the shelf today. Hey, Coke guy, Can we put some more on the shelf? Oh yeah, I totally forgot. My bad. I'll do it today.
You're boom. Helping people.
Yeah, yeah. That's, you're just like friendly reminder.
Problem, Dalton, is that people? So like there are good salespeople and bad salespeople, and in my mind, sure, the biggest difference are the people that are good at it understand when they're actually creating value because that's a salesperson's job. Versus bad people are just like, I need to sell this thing. So it's like, if you're good at your job, when I go to these stores and I tell them like, hey, you need to put my cookie dough on the shelf, I am doing them a favor.
Right. You're if helping them
on the shelf. They're losing money. I am doing you a favor. If you start rewiring your brain to think like that, and then in the reverse, if your product's not moving off the shelf, stop trying to sell it to these people. Maybe tell them that you can stop putting it on the shelf at all. You don't need to do that. But like, that's an honest and open thing to do. Or like if you're selling franchises, that's like, or you're like raising money. That's another area where like there are a ton of bad salespeople and there are very few good. Because good when you're selling franchises is like, am I vetting you? Am I making sure you're right for this business? Are you pumped about it? Like, is this going to work out? Are you going to be in that store? Like, those are questions the salesperson is answering while also trying to get them interested in the concept. And that's really hard to do.
Yeah,
I think scale, the people that are the best at it probably don't even exist. Because the best people in franchise sales I have met are really scammy. And they turn and burn franchisees. That's what they do. And
that's wild, dude.
It is wild. It's really sad. You guys are really familiar with them.
Yeah. Well,
anybody who is a franchise chain, especially in dessert, that's growing really fast, is fucking people over. And I know that because I have been doing it for a long time. And you could go back to frozen yogurt.
Yeah.
I know a guy that worked for Rita's Italian Ice when they were blowing up right before the Great Recession in like 2007, sold 200 franchises in 1 year. Do you know how many opened ever? Whoa. You're talking about like maybe 30 of the 200. So all these people paid and then like either got the franchise agreement terminated, couldn't finance it. Like there were all kinds of problems. Or like this thing opened stores. There's all kinds of, and people have a hard time wrapping their mind around it. Like, why would someone pay the franchise fee? It's like, dude, really good salespeople can get someone to buy. Like, it is impressive.
Yeah.
I've seen the stories where, whether it be like Rita's, which is a great brand, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't want to shit on them. But like, I just knew that guy anecdotally, and this was like 20 years ago. So nobody hate on them. I will not name them. But there are a lot of other dessert brands. You could go to frozen yogurt, cookies, cookie dough, whatever, where like people were just turning and burning franchisees. That was the goal.
Yeah.
And it's because like vetting someone for a concept like that is so hard. And you kind of already know what you're selling them is not what they're expecting.
Right.
Like a lot of the times they're expecting this thing that is not actually what they want. And they want a rental house. They don't want
I know exactly what you're talking about, dude. So we don't work with brokers. All of our franchise sales are in-house. But I've kind of ventured out into the broker world a little bit, and it's wild, dude. It's pretty crazy. And you know what's even weirder about franchise sales is it's kind of like a bros club almost. You know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to get into for some reason, and even harder to like stay in. I don't know, man. It's one of the weirdest sales environments that I've ever been in.
Yeah. I met a lot of really sketchy people when we were franchising, and we only franchised for about a year, and it's not something that, it's not something that's easy. But there is a right way to do it. It is something that we've considered doing again as a growth strategy. It's something that I've seen other people do it. There's a company we work with in the Southeast called Perfect 10 Foods. They're our distributor. Founded by the guys that own King of Pops, which is a popsicle brand. And basically his franchisees for King of Pops in each city also buy from Perfect 10. It distributes all their popsicles to them. And then those franchisees also act as salespeople for their wholesale accounts.
Yeah.
And they act as salespeople for the distributor. And it's like this really weird, cool model. where like they've got people doing like all these different jobs that like support the like product and the brand. Yeah. But like, it wasn't like, let's go sell like a million franchises. It was more right. like sell them to people that kind of seem like they know what they're doing. They care about this.
They want it to work. Like yeah. that's the thing with franchisees is like some people are just like, oh, I bought a business and I'm not going to have to, or like it's plug and play. Like, yeah, but plug and play doesn't mean that you're not going to have to like work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And it also means like you're going to have to put a lot of work in and
yeah, figure beforehand. Yeah. And like, yeah, what's your training and support like? Well, we have a lot, but that doesn't mean you can sit on your ass all day.
Yeah, it's like, training support is literally like, you know, I'll make sure you don't have to like wait too long to get a question answered.
Right. Or like you don't, one thing that I always say is like our training and support is like, you won't have to guess on what to do next, but yeah. you'll still have to do it.
That's actually really, yeah. I love that, Dalton. I'm going to steal
yeah.
that.
Yeah, good. But, yeah, steal it, dude. It's not mine.
I'm posting that on LinkedIn today.
Good for you, dude. Good for you. But yeah, I mean, that's how I put it. It's just like you won't have to question on what to do next. But like, this isn't going to be, if you think it, if you're hoping that this will be a set it and forget it, then like, let's just do both ourselves a favor and just not worry about this anymore. Like, that's not go buy Robert Kiyosaki's book and learn about his rental MLM scam that he went bankrupt on. You can do something like that. I don't know. I like shitting on Robert Kiyosaki.
Yeah, it's understandable.
Dude, well, this was an amazing conversation, bro. I really appreciate you being here and sharing your story and teaching people, man. So before I let you go, where can everybody find you?
So everyone can find me on LinkedIn or Instagram. I post all of my thoughts there. That's at Jim. I think it's at James Feeman. On LinkedIn, I'm Jimmy Feeman. And then you can find No Baked at No Baked, NOBAKED on Instagram, LinkedIn, TikTok, Twitter, everywhere. Check us out. And you can find us also on our website at nobaked.co. Check us out in a grocery store near you in the Southeastern Midwest if you're shopping for cookie dough.
Oh, heck yeah, dude. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jimmy.
All right. Thank you, Dalton.